Something else. She thinks the above list may be a little confusing for readers. Okay, Jen. My ladies and gents are pretty sharp, and I'm fairly certain it isn't confusing to them. But fine, just in case, I now give you the extremely easy-to-read food diet chart, which is given out only in Hollywood. Don't tell anyone I gave this to you. See, the top-secret Hollywood food chart. Wow, I cannot believe you guys got me to give you the Top Secret Hollywood Secrets food chart. I am going to get in so much trouble. Now, moving on to working out. You may not believe this, but some of the ways regular people stay in shape are actually the same here, too. I've been told that non-Hollywood people run or walk outside or on a treadmill, attend classes, and do yoga. Well, we here in Hollywood also do those things. But in Hollywood, clinical trials have shown that you burn more calories if you run while being photographed by paparazzi. Also, spinning classes are proven to be more effective if you spin while being motivated, read, screamed at, by someone who is 10 years younger and 10 times more attractive than you. Yoga must be done in a studio where the temperature is at least 411 degrees. Oh, and you should probably start working on your ensemble now for the workout class you have in 3 days. As a person, you are worthless without a high-fashion workout ensemble. These are the only basic differences between Hollywood and you. Also, I've learned it's not enough to just work out vigorously 3 to 5 times a week because your body is smarter than you are and quickly adapts to any athletic activity you do repeatedly, rendering your efforts almost useless. To combat this, you must constantly change up your already vigorous routine so that you trick your body in order to keep it guessing. This sounds strange, I know. In fact, just this morning while I was driving to spin class, I was thinking about how odd the concept is, and it occurred to me that, wah, the joke's on you, body, because I was taking your ass to Pilates. Ha! See what I did there? A Japanese healer once told me that because I don't breathe properly, most of the exercise I do does not even register with my physical self. Sometimes you have a body that just won't quit, but in this case, I'm stuck with one that refuses to listen. Hollywood has taught me you must never relax with regard to your body. It is out to get you. You must stay at least one step ahead of your body at all times. This makes no sense, you say. How are you supposed to do that? Guys, it's all in the chart. I mean, come on. But you all have personal trainers who do all the work for you. It's not fair. When I can, I work out with Michelle Lovett, an incredible person who's an excellent trainer and friend. Michelle is positive and knowledgeable and encouraging and also happens to be a super babe. From Michelle, I've learned useful information. You have to be consistent, and it helps to wear a heart rate monitor to keep track of calories burned and make sure you're in the fat-burning zone. Of course, it is enormously helpful to work out with a partner who knows her stuff. But as another trainer I know says, we aren't the dry cleaner. You can't just do whatever you want during the off hours and expect to pick up your clothes an hour later looking like new. You are the clothes in this scenario. Does that make sense? Maybe we need another chart? I think part of our frustration slash fascination in this arena is because we're always holding out hope that there's a secret combination of elements that will make something that isn't easy a little easier. I started putting lumps of grass-fed butter in my coffee and the pounds just melted away. But I'm sorry to tell you that in my experience, there's no secret to accomplishing almost any goal worth pursuing. And what is the goal, exactly? To make it to the Smucker's salute on the Today Show? Hi, Natalie! My grandmother is turning 96 years old in a month, and I don't think I've ever seen anything labeled organic in her refrigerator. She's a woman of deep faith and intelligence. Maybe we should try bottling that? Someone call Shark Tank! I know it's frustrating, but don't despair. I have a few more top-secret Hollywood secrets for you. 1. If you're trying to lose weight, you're going to be hungry most of the day, fairly cranky, and irritating to your friends. Or maybe it's your friends who are irritating. It's hard to tell because you're so hungry. And you need to be like this every day for about 2 weeks to see results. 2. I lost the most weight once right after a bad breakup, and then again while rehearsing a Broadway show. Try to arrange for these things to happen at the same time, and then you'll really be looking good. 3. Most successful diets involve eating very clean, healthy foods in small quantities with very few carbohydrates, almost no sugar, very little alcohol, and a ton of physical activity. This combination appears in almost every diet book out there. You can combine foods, count points, or act like you are French, Greek, Spanish, or Beyonce. While each diet varies slightly, I've read every single one of them, and I can assure you they all have the above in common. 4. Bell bottoms will go in and out of style every few years for the rest of your life. This is a bit off topic, but just another thing I keep meaning to tell you. They'll change them just enough to make you think you need new ones. You do not. Keep the ones you already have. Stars may or may not be just like us, but generally, I've learned it's a mistake to think anyone else has the answer to pretty much anything. When I hear Kim Kardashian lost her baby weight on Atkins, I'll eat steak for 3 days straight until I remember that, oh yeah, I've tried this before and it didn't make me feel that great. You have to find what works for you, not what works for someone else. I kept trying to be a vegan until I realized that part of my motivation was that I wanted to be able to go on the Ellen show and bond with her over it. I respect and adore Ellen so much, and she has always been so supportive of me as an actor, writer, and producer. Because of her, I got to turn my novel, Someday, Someday, Maybe, into a pilot script for the CW, and I co-wrote another half-hour pilot for her company as well. She gave me opportunities I'd never had before, and it's like I wanted to repay her by being more like her, which, if you think about it, is also the premise of the stalker movie Single White Female. It's great to look up to people you admire, but you can't make life decisions motivated by the hope that you'll be invited to Ellen and Portia's to eat lentils and watch Scandal. Anyway, if you're truly fed up and confused about all this, good news! For you, we have Soylent, a sludge-colored meal replacement concoction invented by people in Silicon Valley to enable them to cut out the pesky time that eating requires. Lunch, pah, what a waste of brain power. And devote more time to creating new face-swapping apps. Meals including food? What are you, some sort of time-wasting East Coast pizza eater? Every morning, my father eats half a loaf of bread with butter, a giant smoothie, maybe an omelet with cheese, and then he has breakfast. I just want a piece of toast once in a while. Is that so wrong? Plus, I think it should be against the law to feel down on yourself regarding any issues that Oprah is still working on. And Oprah is still working on this issue. She has rubbed elbows with heads of state and every celebrity in the universe, opened a school in Africa, among other accomplishments, made millions of dollars, and helped scores of people live a better life. But by her own admission, she's still working on diet-related topics. So to sum it up, let's all chillax about it and spend more time being kind to ourselves and doing truly useful things, like trying to resuscitate words that were never cool like chillax. Good news! My accountant has just informed me that by imparting all these top-secret Hollywood secrets to you, I've now saved you at least 1 zillion American dollars. Just make sure to mention me when you talk about it on the Today Show. Hi, Kathy Leonhoda. There is only one Betty White, or Paper Towels, a Love Story. I don't know if we'll ever live in a world where 16-year-old boys will throw their PlayStations in the trash because they've discovered they'd rather sit in the movie theater watching Best Exotic Marigold Hotel 12. But I'm guessing it probably won't be in my lifetime. Most movies are made for people who want to watch Jurassic World over and over. Hollywood is mostly for young people. And young people mostly like to look at other young people because that's who they relate to. The people who pay for movies and TV to get made are mainly making them for young people too. In television, young people are people ages 18 to 49. You may have heard of these people. They're sometimes referred to as the key demographic. They're the ones whose attention advertisers most want to capture on television and in the movies, and I'm going to tell you why. Paper towels. I was recently at the house of a friend who just made one of those trips to Costco where you feel really smug about all the money you saved until you get home and can't fit the 20-pound jar of generic peanut butter in any of your cupboards because you forgot about the 10 giant jars you already have. So she was trying to get rid of some stuff. She offered me one of those 12 packs of paper towels that can also be used as an air mattress if you have a guest over, and I was pretty psyched to take it off her hands. I happened to actually need paper towels, and I was like, wow, what a great coincidence. Then I looked at them a little more closely and I realized they weren't my brand of paper towels. I always feel guilty when I use paper towels, but what makes me feel slightly better is getting the kind that are perforated at narrower intervals and can be ripped off into smaller sections. I feel better because at least I'm not using a whole towel. So I turned down these free, non-perforated paper towels, which my friend thought was crazy, and that's how I suddenly realized I was out of the key demo. To some degree, I get why our business likes them young. Advertisers want people they can convert, people who haven't yet made up their minds about things like what their favorite paper towels are or what car they like to drive, people who might change their minds and switch to a different brand because of the ads they see. But as consumers get older, they decide what they like to use and they hardly ever deviate, which means advertisers need to move on to influence the next batch of potential paper towel devotees. Which is why there aren't more older people, especially women, who apparently have a tendency to pick their paper towel preferences earliest, in movies and television. But what about Betty White, you ask? You're right. Betty White is hilarious, talented, and still working. That is so incredibly rare that she is literally the only person anyone ever mentions when challenging my paper towel theory. No one ever says, what about Betty White and Bathsheba Flellington? Because Bathsheba Flellington stopped getting work years ago, and that's only partially because I made her up. There simply isn't a ton of work for women in her category, and therefore there isn't one other example of a Betty White type other than Betty White herself. There are a handful of women who are slightly younger than Betty that I could cite as examples, it's true, but I dare you to name five who aren't Meryl Streep and Diane Keaton or who don't also have the word dame in front of their name. Carrie Fisher is one of my favorite actors and writers. I've enjoyed her films, seen her on Broadway, and read everything she's written. When I was writing my novel, Someday, Someday, Maybe, I kept her Postcards from the Edge on my desk the whole time, and when I got stuck, I'd pick it up and reread sections I'd already read a dozen times. Our books are very different, but the fact that she is an actress who wrote a novel, one that was loosely based on her own life, and became a successful screenwriter, was a big inspiration to me. Recently, Carrie Fisher responded to a New York Post article that quoted her mentioning the pressure she'd felt to lose weight for the most recent Star Wars film. The writer commented that if she didn't like being judged on her looks, she should quit acting. He went on to say regarding her work as a writer, no one would know the name Carrie Fisher if it weren't for her ability to leverage her looks. Carrie Fisher is a best-selling author and screenwriter, giant movie star, and all-around attractive person. And there are a lot, and I mean a lot, of really beautiful people in New York and Los Angeles who've come to those places in an attempt to become actors. If getting work as an actor was simply about leveraging your looks, if that was the sole currency of success in our field, then everyone on Vanderpump Rules would be winning Oscars one day, and I would be the center pullout thing in next month's Maxim. I'm not saying either thing can't happen, but it hasn't yet. Perhaps because there's at least a subtle difference between acting on a reality show and modeling on one hand, and being a talent like Carrie Fisher on the other. Leveraging one's looks is just one component. Also, I'm not even sure Maxim has a center pullout thing. One day, I might not feel like leveraging my looks anymore, and I'm okay with that. I'd like to age gracefully, although I'm not yet entirely sure what that will mean. I just know there are certain things I don't want to have to do to look younger. I don't have problems with plastic surgery in theory. Wait, that's not true. I do sort of have problems with it. I'm just trying to sound blasé about something that's currently fashionable but also troubling to me. See also high-waisted jeans. For starters, as a viewer, I just can't stand when it's all I can see. Suddenly I go from watching a scene with two actors I like to being more focused on a conversation between upper lip filler and Botox, and it's too distracting. If I could be guaranteed that no one, including myself, would notice something I did to my face to look younger or somehow better, maybe I'd do it. But I feel like I have one of those faces that shows that sort of stuff too easily, and I don't want to be worried that you'll start mistaking my forehead for a skating rink. Also, while there's nothing wrong with doing things to make you feel better, I just wish the choices were limited to simpler things many of us have access to, like drinking more water, or jogging, or finding a more flattering shade of lipstick. It's a bummer that it's even an option to appear more youthful by chopping off your ears and reattaching them in order to hoist up your neck flaps. This may not be the precise surgical term. It's confusing to me that my aversion to doing this has any sort of bearing on my work as an actor. You mean you aren't willing to chop off and reattach your ears in order to hoist up your neck flaps, Lauren? Don't you care about us? Where's your commitment to your craft? Mean people on the internet yell. I wish this possibility simply didn't exist, so that we all had somewhat of a fair playing field. But this is as futile a concept as my belief that everyone who's born should automatically be allowed to live until age 85. The people who treat themselves the most healthfully would get extra credit, more time to live longer. The partiers and couch potatoes would get docked points, living less long. This system is much more fair than the random, sometimes smokers live into their 90s, while marathon runners occasionally drop dead at 45 thing we've got going now, but alas. Another remarkable thing about Betty White is that she went from being 20 and 30-something Betty to 80-something Betty while maintaining the same wonderful quality she always had of just plain being Betty White. No matter what character she plays, Betty White is always funny, always smart, and always at least a little sexy. She didn't set herself up early on as hot temptress Betty White, and therefore she didn't have to desperately try to cling to her hot temptress persona, pretending with each passing year that nothing had changed. She didn't have to face headlines like, Betty White, hot temptress, back and better than ever, or Betty White, still hot temptress, or sad Betty White, seen clubbing at Limelight, desperate to reign as hot temptress once more. Also, that Limelight, which closed in the 1990s, I think, is literally the only club name I could think of, should tell you a great deal about my clubbing habits. In The First Wives Club, Goldie Hawn's actress character says there are only three ages for women in Hollywood. Babe, District Attorney, and Driving Miss Daisy. This suggests that acting careers follow a three-act structure, which makes sense. For the people who are willing to do the ear staple neck flap surgery, perhaps the second act lasts longer. I haven't gotten to my last act yet. Old Granny Sackpants? Cranky Irish Potato Maven? But so far, for me, career-wise, I'd call my first two acts Gal About Town and The Mom. Gal About Town is a career girl on the go. She's looking for love, but can't be tied down yet because she's trying to get ahead at the office. Occasionally, she's part of a couple, but mainly she's single and career-focused and goes out on dates that don't go well. G.A.T., Gat, meets friends in bars and stays out late and takes fashion risks. She wears high-heeled shoes, and her winter coat is red or yellow. She has lots of girlfriends she can call when times get tough. Often one of her best friends is a guy she could never picture herself being with romantically, but eventually she'll realize she was wrong and he was the one all along, and isn't it ironic that he was right there in front of her the whole time? When I started out, I did a lot of guest spots, and almost all of them were Gats. Seinfeld, Law & Order, News Radio. My other gals about town, Liz in Good Company, Molly in Conrad Bloom, Jules in One True Thing, Sue in Bad Santa, she really got around town. Maggie in Because I Said So. The mom, on the other hand, wears plaid shirts and sneakers and is usually described as tired, beleaguered, or possessing a faded beauty. The mom is often harried or overworked, and we know this because usually in her very first scene, she says frustratedly, "Guys, come on, we're going to be late." The mom is often single, but we don't always know exactly why or what happened. There will be one scene where the mom is with her kids and wistfully refers to your father, but we aren't sure if he's dead or just away somewhere. Weirdly, the mom doesn't seem to have that many friends. At most, she has one recently divorced friend who dates younger men and smokes and tells the mom she needs to get out more. While the Gats usually have tons of personality traits and quirks, the moms aren't usually as specific. Almost every mom I've played has a scene where she folds laundry. The Gats never do this. They must be too busy having dates with Mr. Wrong and getting their dry cleaning delivered. Sometimes the director of a mom project won't use my character name, but will just refer to me as the mom, like they're all the same. Okay, now the mom stands over here with the laundry basket. I don't know why the mom can't be as specific and unique as the Gats. I think it's because the Gats are most often in the center of the story, and the mom seldom is, because paper towels. My moms have included Joan in Evan Almighty, Phyllis in Flash of Genius, Pamela in Max, Jules in Middle School. By the time I was cast as Sarah Braverman on Parenthood, playing the mom of two teenagers was age-appropriate. But the first time I read Gilmore Girls, I was 31 years old. I had played the mother of a brand new baby once, Denise on Townies, but even that character was considered a very young mom. For 4 years in Los Angeles, I'd been almost exclusively in the Gat world, but that was about to change. When I got the script for the Gilmore Girls pilot, I was in New York, staying in a friend's studio apartment, waiting to hear if the series I just completed for NBC, Don Roos's MYOB, was going to be picked up for a second season or canceled. Waiting to hear if your TV show is going to be picked up or not is always a stressful time. Did you hear anything? You ask your agent roughly 12 times a day. By call number 5, your agent mysteriously begins to be in a meeting with Hugh Jackman buying pants or out foraging for truffles. The Gilmore Girls script had actually been sent to me once before, but I hadn't read it. I didn't want to read something and fall in love with it, only to find out I wasn't available. But they hadn't found anyone, and they were still interested. They'll take you in second position now, my agent told me. which meant that, unlike the first time I'd been sent the script, they were willing to roll the dice. If I auditioned and they wanted me, they'd go ahead and shoot the pilot with me, hoping the other show didn't get picked up. And that's what happened. Well, what really happened was that I got the part, shot the pilot, and chewed off my fingernails for the next 3 months, during which time Gilmore Girls was picked up at the WB, but MYOB wasn't yet canceled at NBC. There was still the possibility of a second season. Years later, one of the TV executives who'd been involved at the time told me they'd finally cleared me for Gilmore Girls because they'd swapped me for another actor at some other network who was also tied to two projects, confirming my suspicion that if you want to know what Hollywood is really like, just watch The Hunger Games over and over. But after all that, the part was mine, and I was set to play Lorelai Gilmore, the 32-year-old mother of a 16-year-old girl. When I told people the premise of Gilmore Girls, most of them, especially other actresses my age, would inevitably say, "Don't you worry about getting typecast as the mom? Aren't you worried it will age you?" But honestly, I never thought once about it. To me, Lorelai was equal parts gal about town and the mom, plus a magical mix of smarts and humor that made her totally unique. I read somewhere that Christopher Reeve said one of the ways he knew a part was for him was when he couldn't stand the idea of anyone else doing it. I know that exact feeling. There's a sort of manic recognition that happens very rarely when I read something I want so much that I go briefly but totally bonkers. That feeling is a combination of, "Hello, old friend," meets, "Everyone get out of my way, she's mine, all mine." At the time, I'd been in a string of shows that hadn't lasted very long. I worked enough and fairly steadily, but nothing had come close to sticking. Yet when I told my mom about Gilmore Girls, I remember her saying, "I have a feeling about this one." And she was right. I know how lucky I am to have had such wonderful first and second acts in my career. I'm still not sure what my third act will turn out to be. Sexy baking competition hostess? Flamboyant Peruvian bingo caller? But if you happen to run into Betty White, tell her thank you. I'd like to be like her one day. What It Was Like, Part 1. Do you ever find yourself walking down the street thinking, "I feel like Lauren likes me, but does she love me?" The answer is yes. Yes, I do. And I'm going to prove it to you by doing something I haven't done in approximately 15 years, not even for friends or relatives or employers. I'm going to watch myself on television. I'm not sure when I stopped watching things I was in. It's probably more like I never really started. I learned fairly early on that I was not one of those actors who was helped by seeing myself on screen. It took at least 3 viewings of something I was in to even begin to be objective, and on Gilmore Girls, we did 22 episodes each season. If I stayed inside watching myself for all those hours, I'd never make it out to the grocery store, not to mention I'd become unbearable as a human. Making so many episodes for 7 years straight did something funny to my memory, too. And so today, it's hard to recall exactly what was going on back then or distinguish season from season. But I want to tell you what it was like for me to play Lorelai all of those years. So I'm going to at least scroll through all the episodes to see what I can come up with to give you a sense of it as best I can. The internet has already done its job in terms of ranking episodes and naming its favorites. My goal here is just to give you my take on what was going on personally. Just so you have a visual, I'm in my apartment in Manhattan, and it's the summertime. It's 1 million degrees outside, and my sister and most of my friends who live here are out of town at a beach somewhere. There's almost no one in my apartment building, which means not only am I going to spend the next 3 days watching myself, I am also going to be my only company. So if, during this time, TMZ reports that I've gone crazy and trapped the Chinese food delivery man inside my apartment because I just needed someone to talk to, you'll understand why. Making the pilot. Alexis Bledel and I met for the very first time in the lobby of a hotel in Toronto. Can you believe that? We'd both been cast in the show without ever having met. I was cast very late in the process, partially because of the MYOB thing. So there was no time for a chemistry read, usually a minimum requirement when casting two actors whose relationship is vital to the success of a show. There'd been no time for anyone to even see us standing side by side just to make sure we looked related. We met in that lobby and went straight to dinner with our new employers, series creator Amy Sherman Palladino, executive producer Dan Palladino, and producer Gavin Pallone. I was overwhelmed, but I could tell I liked her right away. She was only 18 years old, but kind and curious and beautiful, of course. I had a good feeling about us from the start. We clicked as friends right away, too. But it was all a stroke of luck. A few months later, the show was picked up, which was exciting but also worrisome because, as I mentioned, I wasn't actually available to do it. If NBC decided they wanted to keep going with MYOB, I'd have to be replaced on Gilmore Girls. So, in a strange sort of limbo, I traveled to New York in May 2000 for the Upfronts, the annual event where networks present their new season to advertisers to promote Gilmore Girls. In the green room, where the actors and executives mingled before going on stage, there was a giant screen where a clip reel of all the new shows being launched was playing on a loop. Some WB executives came over to introduce themselves. "The show looks great," one of them said, just as my face came on the screen behind him. "Tough time slot," said another. "Why? What's the time slot?" I asked. "Today, if a new show of mine was picked up, that's one of the first things I'd want to know. Back then, it somehow hadn't occurred to me to find out." "Thursdays at 8, he told me. Even the less savvy me of the time knew what that meant. My stomach dropped. "Oh, so we're already canceled," I joked. He didn't say anything, but smiled sympathetically and sort of shrugged in a way that said he didn't disagree. Thursday night on NBC was, in the year 2000, the biggest ratings night on all of television. We'd be up against Friends, the number one show at the time. The WB itself was still very new, and the ratings, even of their most successful shows, already tended to be much lower than those of the big four networks. So on Thursday nights against America's favorite sitcom, we had almost zero chance of finding an audience. "Oh well," I thought, "I probably can't do this show anyway. And even if I was let out of my MYOB contract, I faced a Thursday time slot that basically spelled doom. Here we go again," I thought. I'd worked fairly steadily since moving to Los Angeles from New York, but every single show I'd done up until then had been canceled in its first season. Why should Gilmore Girls be any different? I'd fallen in love with the script right away, but I loved MYOB too, and the ratings were only so-so. My show business heart had been broken before, and I was starting to get used to it. I turned back to the clip reel, just as Gilmore Girls came on again. "Goodbye, new show," I said to myself. In front of me, two women who looked to be pretty close in age were watching the screen. As our scenes played, they gasped and grabbed onto each other, their faces lighting up. "Mom, that's us," the daughter said, beaming at her young-looking mother. They seemed shocked and pleased to see themselves reflected in the characters. Something had clearly struck a chord with them in a big way. Season 1. The first scene we filmed is the first scene you see in the pilot. A guy in Luke's hits on Rory and then Lorelai, and we reveal they aren't girlfriends, as he assumed, but in fact, mother and daughter. Watch it back, and you won't believe you're watching a young actress, Alexis, in her first on-camera scene. Also, what's so funny about this pilot by today's standards is that while the dialogue is delightful from the start, nothing really happens for the first 15 or 20 minutes until Rory gets into Chilton and Lorelai has to ask her parents for money. Today, if a mother and daughter speaking clever dialogue didn't also reveal themselves to be surgeons, werewolves, or undercover detectives by the end of the teaser, we'd never be picked up. Also, we all look 12 years old. Frankly, what I remember most when I watched this season is the degree to which I was on an adrenaline-fueled dialogue high the whole year, if that makes any sense. I hadn't had material this dense since back in acting school. I found the pace and sheer volume of it exhilarating. Rather than being tired out by the long hours, I had extra energy as a result. I slept about 4 hours a night and still felt great. I ran every day at lunch in the WB gym. Ah, youth. Watching Scott Patterson this season reminds me, you know, that part wasn't necessarily the inevitable love interest for Lorelai that it became. He was simply cute, grouchy diner owner in the beginning, and it could have gone in any number of directions. But Luke took on a more important role because of Scott's special sexiness, which was mixed with a gruffness that was the perfect contrast to Lorelai's chirpy cheerfulness. Watch and learn, young actors. If you're interesting, the camera finds you. Kelly Bishop and Ed Herman were perfectly cast as Emily and Richard. They both exude aristocratic elegance that tells you right away the kind of household Lorelai grew up in and why she might have found it a bit stuffy at times. As actors, they both have emotional depth and impeccable comic timing. Plus, as people, they're pure joy to be around. A few months into filming that year, I remember Alexis and I went to see Melissa McCarthy perform in The Groundlings for the first time, and we were completely blown away by her. I wondered then if anyone would ever figure out a way to expose how uniquely talented she was. Of course, her Suki character was a delight, but could she find a way to showcase the other hilarious and original characters she was able to create? Why, yes, people. Yes, she could. David Sutcliffe's Christopher is so appealing, it makes you wonder once in a while if Lorelai and Rory's dad should have stayed together after all. And Yannick Truesdale created such a unique character in Michelle, especially since in person he's warm and funny and hardly ever suffers from ennui like Michelle does. So many other players make Stars Hollow what it is. I'm always wowed by Sally Struthers' humor and warmth, Liz Torres' sultry delivery, and Sean Gunn's total commitment to whatever Kirk's new passion is. I love the fun feuds between Lane and Mrs. Kim. Michael Winters makes those long Taylor speeches look effortless, and Rose Abdu's Gypsy is just a gem. Most other shows on the WB at the time were peopled with young hotties. I love that we were peopled with a lot of interesting people. Times were different. Lorelai complains when Emily tries to install a DSL line, claiming she doesn't need one. Ha ha ha, yes you do, Lorelai, and just you wait a few years till your BlackBerry stops working altogether. Rory wonders if there's still hope for Sean Penn and Madonna. There isn't. Kelly complains about kids today wasting their time watching MTV and 100 TV channels, which doesn't seem like all that many by today's standards. And I write my number down for Max Medina on a business card. Fashion and hair. Wow, lots of leather blazers and blue eyeshadow? For some reason, I was very into blue eyeshadow this year. My makeup artist at the time worried it was a bit much, but I liked anything bright and bold for Lorelai. Donna Karan nylons abound. They were new and very popular. There were no Spanx back then, and these stockings with serious control top built in were revolutionizing ladies' stomachs all across the land. My skirts are very short this year, my hair is very black, and I remember there was much discussion about what to do about it. The hair, not the skirts. No one in the history of television has ever worried about skirts being too short. Boring but important hair note, the color was just one of my hair issues. My hair is also naturally curly and extremely sensitive to the weather. This means that in order for me to wear it curly, it has to first be straightened, then curled, which sort of defeats the whole supposed luck of having naturally curly hair in the first place. So figuring out how best to make it last throughout a 14-hour day took some experimentation over the years. Stay tuned for the exciting results. What I love. There are so many great episodes from this year, but for me, the show really hits its stride in episode 6, Rory's Two Birthdays, where the Gilmores have a very fancy party for Rory that's in stark contrast to the cozy one Lorelai throws, full of junk food and a cake with Rory's face on it and Stars Hollow locals. Kelly is marvelous in the scene in Lorelai's bedroom where she sees a picture of Lorelai with a broken leg, and they both really begin to get, in a new way, how much they've missed not being part of each other's lives. From the start of the show, Kelly named herself my TVM, or TV Mom, by which she meant she was taking her character's role seriously, beyond the pages or the sets, and out into the real world. Right away, we developed the easy rituals of old friends, meeting for lunch at Joe Allen in New York, or out for guacamole at our favorite Mexican place in L.A., or allowing ourselves to split a little bag of Cheetos when we were filming in the middle of the night. In a maternal, protective way, she found most of my boyfriends at the time lacking, and once told me I needed someone who was more my equal, like that wonderful actor on 6 Feet Under. Season finale. Over the course of this first season, we began to realize that our tough time slot might actually have been a gift. What expectation could the network possibly have for us to get any ratings against such tough competition? Yet bit by bit, we began to accumulate nice notices and loyal viewers. In the last episode, Rory finally says, "I love you," to Dean, and Max Medina proposes to Lorelai with 1,000 yellow daisies, although weirdly he does it over the phone. If you've ever seen series creator Amy Sherman-Palladino in person or read her interviews, you already know she's very, very funny and very, very bright. But the mind of the person who conceives of such a grand romantic gesture as this? Genius. See photo 8, Lorelei surrounded by daisies. Season 2. This year, the WB moved us to Tuesday nights at 8. So long, friends! And the ratings began ticking up. I was nominated for a Golden Globe and a SAG Award, and I also got to present at the Emmys. My dates to these events were, in order, my manager, my dad, and my cousin Tim. I was very popular with people I worked with and or was related to. Times were different. Christopher gives Lorelei a DVD of The Graduate, no Netflix then, and a disposable camera. These were a huge innovation at the time to take pictures at Rory's graduation. A classmate of Lorelei's complains about her job at Kinko's, ubiquitous copy places before FedEx took over the world. And Lorelei and Rory invite Dean over to watch the TV movie, Tears and Laughter, The Joan and Melissa Rivers Story, starring Joan and Melissa Rivers as themselves. Which reminds me, Joan Rivers was a fellow Barnard alum, and was always so nice and supportive when I saw her on the red carpet. To my knowledge, she always went easy on me, fashion-wise. When I co-wrote a pilot about an aspiring late-night talk show host, played by me, I had my character, me, speak to a photo of Joan she keeps on her dressing room mirror. As both a comedian and an inspiration, she's missed. Fashion and hair. I mean, I opened the season wearing a sleeveless t-shirt with the face of a pug on it. In the second episode, just for variety, I sport a sleeveless t-shirt that gives the illusion that I was also wearing a bunch of pearl necklaces. My fashion evolution this year couldn't be more evident. Please see photo 9, me in weird t-shirt with newspaper veil. Slip dresses were also very big in 2001, and I wear a lot of them this season. Although, am I the only one who's noticed that slip dresses are basically indistinguishable from plain old slips because they are, in fact, not dresses, but just slips? We were all running around in our undergarments feeling fancy-free. They're back in fashion now, and still, no one has blown the lid off this conspiracy to get us to pay more just to wear our underwear in public. Over the summer, I dyed my hair red, because it seemed like a fun idea, and then had to dye it back for the show. So this season, my hair is black with red undertones and super damaged. At some point, I did this Japanese straightening treatment that was all the rage then, and my hair turned stick straight and shiny, yet rigid and broom-like. What I love. Episode 4, Road Trip to Harvard, where, in the face of Max and Lorelei's breakup, Rory and Lorelei bond on the road. And Episode 7, Like Mother, Like Daughter, where Kelly and I model the same fashions. Also, that diet Michelle talks about, where he's reducing his calories by 30% because a study showed it helped rats live longer, it was based on the real-life diet of our producer and health buff, Gavin Pallone. He is, to this day, extremely thin, although probably also 30% hungrier than the rest of us are. Season finale. Where Oi with the Poodles already was born! I've said it on command for you in airports across the land, but honestly, I forgot where exactly in the show it appeared. Now I remember! For you speed nerds, note how, over the course of this year, the pace of the show increased exponentially, and everyone began talking a whole lot faster. This was around the time when we started to be known for that. Watch the first and last episodes back to back, and it's super evident. I was sort of talking that way already, but it starts to become stars hollow wide. This resulted in our already lengthy scripts getting even longer. Also, I remember having an audition this year, and being asked before I went in if I could talk normally. Ha! Also, in general, how great is Liza Weil as Paris? Discuss. Season 3. Ah, yes! Here's the episode 8 o'clock at the Oasis where I single-handedly launched John Hamm's career by casting him as Peyton Sanders. Just kidding. I had nothing to do with his casting or any of his success to come. But I do remember thinking what a talented, foxy dude he was. In the episode Lorelei Out of Water, my fishing gear looks are truly upsetting. That's my friend Billy Burke playing my beau, and Adam Brody is so charming as Dave Rogalski. Times were different. In the second episode this year, someone Star 69's our cassette tape-based answering machine. Fashion and hair. In the opening scene this season, I'm wearing a nightgown. Or is it a slip dress? Lots of floral prints this year, and it looks like I was giving curly hair another go. Let's see how many episodes I last before abandoning this folly. Will I never learn? What I love. The speech in the first episode where Lorelei confesses to Luke she's worried she'll never have the whole package now that she and Christopher have broken up. It was timely for Lorelei, and I think for me too. Amy wrote and directed this episode, and Luke consoles Lorelai in such a generous way, even though you can tell it's causing him pain to do so. Well played, Scott Patterson. And in the episode, the big one, Liza gives her fantastic I'm not going to Harvard speech. Amy wrote this one too. She really is the master of moments that are heartbreakingly funny. Season finale. That's my sister Maggie sitting right between Rory and Paris at the Chilton graduation. See photo 10. Over the years, many family members made cameos, in fact. My cousin Tim still talks about his favorite episode, the one about the guy carrying flowers through the lobby of the Dragonfly. He obviously starred in it, as the guy. I'm sure it's your favorite episode, too. Rory's speech to Lorelai at graduation gets me every time. Oh, and the season began with Lorelai having a dream about being with Luke, and ends with Luke having one about Lorelai. I never noticed that parallel before. Season 4. In the second episode this year, that's our dialogue coach, George Bell, playing Professor Bell at Yale. One of my favorite pieces of dialogue actually happens a few episodes later in this exchange between Kelly and me regarding my logo sweatpants. Emily, you have the word juicy on your rear end. Lorelai, well, if I'd known you were coming over, I would have changed. Emily, to what? A brassiere with the word tasty on it? Getting my makeup done for the Festival of Living Art episode every day for a week taught me that I would never want to be in an actual Festival of Living Art torture. However, our makeup artist won an Emmy for this episode, which was pretty darn cool. Times were different. Rory realizes she wrote her Yale moving-in date down wrong when she double-checks her Filofax day planner. Fashion and hair. The season opens with Lorelai and Rory returning from their backpacking trip through Europe. I'm proud, yet horrified, to tell you that the entire outfit I'm wearing in the first scene, the Kelly Green, Everyone Loves an Irish Girl t-shirt, the Ireland soccer jacket, and the oversized knit pom-pom hat with the word Dublin on it, were all from my personal closet. Oh, and the gold clover necklace was mine too. I was really hitting the Irish thing hard. See photo 11 in my insane Irish outfit. Not sure what I did to my hair in episode 15, Scenes from a Mall, but it's suddenly Grand Ole Opry level voluminous. What I love. This was a great season for hunky Milo Ventimiglia as Jess, facing off against hunky Jared Padalecki as Dean. They are both so talented and equally compelling as suitors. I can see why teams formed. I love Michelle's devotion to his Chow Chow, too. This was probably the year Amy and Dan got theirs, to whom they were also extremely dedicated. I also love little clever things like Rory waking up with a post-it on her head that Lorelai left as a reminder, and that a tipping point in Lorelai's feelings for Luke is the discovery that Luke can waltz, embellished with a lot of eyebrow wagging on my part for emphasis. Season finale. In general, I remember being worried about what would change when Rory went off to college and Lorelai and Rory didn't live together anymore, but I think it was handled well. By the end of this season, Luke and Lorelai finally kiss, and Dean and Rory reunite, although he's still married, which is the start of trouble between mother and daughter. All our guys are at bonkers hotness levels this season, and it was so much fun to have my New York-based friend Chris Eigeman, who played Jason Stiles, in town for a while. Season 5. This is basically a whole season of Rory and Lorelai having tension, Emily and Richard having tension, Dean and Lindsay having tension, fight, fight, fight. Times were different. Lorelai says something about being worried there's anthrax on her bagel. Anthrax was terrifying at the time, but it seems like a relatively mellow threat given what we face now. Can you imagine being all that worried today about something coming toward you at the speed of the post office? Also, at a Friday night dinner gone wrong, Lorelai asks one of Emily's maids for a phone book so she and Rory can order a pizza. Fashion and hair. Shrugs, little mini sweaters, are very big this year. Also, wearing short-sleeved shirts layered over contrasting colored long-sleeved shirts. Thankfully, I seem to have managed to tame my country singer hair a bit. I'm wearing my own glasses in We Got Us a Pippi Virgin, which makes me look a little like Tina Fey, I think. Here I am, doing Weekend Update. See photo 12, where I kind of look like Tina Fey. What I love. Talented Matt Zook rejoins the cast, further complicating whom you choose as Rory's destiny. And we hit 100 episodes this year, which was quite a milestone. To celebrate, they brought the cast and crew down to one of the stages where we took a big group photo and were given a giant cake to share. At the time, I thought this was sort of anticlimactic. Like, thanks for the hundreds of hours of work. Please enjoy this vanilla icing. Later, I learned that a 100-episode cake is the standard tradition. Every show that gets there does it. We got a cake on Parenthood, too. So it's a nice thing. But if I ever get close to hitting 100 episodes again, I'm going to try to bump this tradition up to diamonds or a chocolate fountain, at least. In our 100th episode, Emily and Richard renew their wedding vows. Ed's face, as Kelly walks toward him down the aisle, is just beautiful. Season finale. Rory tells Lorelai she wants to take time off from Yale. Lorelai's upset and doesn't want her to move back home. Luke tries to help Lorelai, and her response is, "Luke, will you marry me?" And before he even has time to answer her, it's the end! Wow! As season finales go, it's a pretty exciting one. Season 6. While I totally understood the need to keep the story moving in different directions, I have to admit I struggled with the Lorelai-Rory separation this year. It went on for a while, and Lorelai was so crabby with Rory for several episodes, not to mention that I missed my favorite scene partner. I'd never played a character for this long, and while it's a bad actor cliche to say, my character would never do that, the line between personal and professional starts to get so blurry, and after a while you start to feel like what's happening to your character is also sort of happening to you. I remember talking about it with Amy, who felt it was important developmentally that this always close relationship hit a significant growing pain. Still, I felt bad in scenes where I kept holding a grudge. Also during the season, Lorelai adopts Paul Anka, the dog, not the person, and Rory and Logan in love are extremely fun to watch. Times were different. Lorelai attempts to clean house but refuses to part with most of her VHS tape recordings of old television episodes like Knott's Landing and 21 Jump Street, partially because the commercials are the best part. Fashion and hair. All my blazers look too short. Either that was the fashion that year or I had a growth spurt. Oh, and puffy sleeves on everything, an adornment that my already broad shoulders don't really need. I also seem to be experimenting with wacky necklaces. Wow, my devotion to Diane von Furstenberg wrap dresses really kicks into high gear this season. The same designer plays an important role in the reboot, too, but in an unexpected way. Wait and see. What I love the scene with Kelly in the private plane where she blames herself for Rory's troubles. Vulnerable Emily is so compelling, especially because Kelly only lets her out once in a while. The best part of this season, episode 9, The Prodigal Daughter Returns, where Lorelai and Rory reunite. On the lawn outside Lorelai's house, Lorelai tells Rory she looks so much more silver than she remembers. I just love little poetic touches like that. And that reunion hug was for real. We were both excited to get back to happier times. See photo 13, Lorelai and Rory hug. Season finale. In episode 22, Partings, Lorelai has a recurring dream of being smothered by a walrus and gets a therapy session in her car over her hesitation about marrying Luke. Side note, will somebody please write a thesis paper on all the bizarre dreams these characters have? I still need help deciphering them. Logan says, I love you, then leaves for London. Luke doesn't like ultimatums, and Lorelai ends up in bed with Christopher. This has all the earmarks of a classic, juicy, wacky season finale that tees up the next season wonderfully. But partings indeed. I didn't know it then, but this was Amy and Dan's last episode until 8 years later. Season 7. Well, in many ways, this was a tough year and sort of a jumble for me, memory-wise. For example, apparently, during this season, Christopher and Lorelai get married in Paris. Okay, I have to admit, this seemed so odd to me back then, especially after all that time apart, I just didn't think Lorelai would get married without Rory present, that I somehow managed to completely forget it ever happened. While we were filming the reboot, Dan Palladino had to call one of the superfan assistants in the office to have her explain the whole episode to me in detail. Even then, I wasn't sure she was telling me the truth. No. Really? Are you sure? No. Paris? I kept saying to her. Plus, our network, the WB, merged with another network, UPN, to form a new network, the CW. Like any company, changes at the top trickle down to its employees. The good news was that we survived the merger when many other shows did not. The bad news was that Amy and Dan faced a tough renegotiation and ultimately couldn't agree to terms. Our new showrunners were talented writers who knew the show well, But just like when David Lee Roth was replaced as the lead singer of Van Halen, no matter how hard we tried singing the same songs, they just didn't sound quite the same. Apparently, I stopped listening to music in the 1980s. Alexis and I were at the end of our contracts as well, and about halfway through this season, we started renegotiating too. It was a confusing time. For starters, after almost 7 straight years of extremely long hours, we were both just plain tired. Creatively, we weren't sure where the show was heading, and we were starting to feel a bit uninspired. To both of us, Rory graduating from Yale actually seemed like a logical place to end the story. We both stood to get a raise if we stayed longer, but we loved the show far too much to keep going for that reason alone if the content wasn't good enough. So conversations with our representatives went back and forth, and nothing had been decided by the last day of work. Our director, Lee Shalit-Shemmel, worried about how best to handle the episode, given that none of us knew if we were filming the last one or not. Ultimately, she decided to mimic the final crane shot from the pilot, where the camera pulls back over Lorelai and Rory talking at their table at Luke's diner. I think she did a fantastic job this season in general, and with that episode specifically. She didn't want to jump the gun, but she also wanted to give the fans some closure in case this was indeed farewell. That last day stretched into the night and ended up being more than 21 hours long. I said a bleary and brief goodbye to everyone as the sun was coming up, but it wasn't the quality send-off any of us would have given if we'd known this was the end. Over the next few weeks, various scenarios were discussed, returning for a full season or possibly a shorter farewell season of just 13 episodes, trying to entice Amy and Dan to return, or letting the show go altogether. In the midst of these discussions, I was out to dinner with a friend, and right after we ordered, the waiter came back over to our table. "Your agent's on the phone," he told me. He led me over to the bar and handed me the receiver. "The show's over," my agent said. And suddenly, before the appetizers had even arrived, that was that. Just like I'd never been on a long-running show before, I'd never been at the end of one either, and I didn't know what the protocol was. That day, I was told that I was the first to know and was asked to wait before reaching out to anyone. I assumed this meant everyone would be getting a call, and given the size of the cast, they needed time to do that. But I found out much later that Alexis and I were the only cast members who were officially informed, and others found out in far less conventional ways. Ed Herman learned the show was canceled from the clerk at his video store in Connecticut, for example. If I had it to do over again, I'd have called everyone myself and thrown a party, too. To end so abruptly was such an odd conclusion to our epic adventure. Over the next 8 years, I saw members of the cast socially, but it wasn't until the reunion at the ATX Festival in Austin in March 2015 that we'd all, well, almost all, be together again. In retrospect, the incomplete feeling that was so unsettling at the time the show ended turned out to be a blessing. Had the storylines been sewn up more neatly, it would have been harder to justify returning to them. Over the years, fans continued to ask about a movie, for good reason. In some ways, the characters had been left frozen in midair, with many questions unanswered. Of course, I too wished we'd had more closure on such an important chapter of my life, but I never could have imagined how incredibly satisfying it would be to come back to it all these years later. I never could have predicted the invention of streaming, the appetite for reboots, and how much your enthusiasm would contribute to bringing us back again. I'm thrilled it happened the way it did, but I never saw it coming. You might say I lacked vision, and you'd be right. Frankly, I'm still pretty excited about the whole disposable camera thing. Well, I made it through all 7 seasons. I did almost take the polite Fresh Direct man hostage, but he made it out alive. It was actually nice to revisit the show after all this time. As for the reboot, well, by my calculations, I should be able to watch it sometime in the year 2032. It was so big and wonderful and important to me, the pressure is just too much. I mean, like I said, I really love you. But for me to watch myself in even more episodes, perhaps, as Richard and Emily did, we'll just have to renew our vows. Before my REI card. Some thoughts on being single. In 2002, I was paired up with Peter Krause to present at the SAG Awards. We'd met before in the late 90s on an episode of Caroline in the City, where we were both guest stars, but back then there was never a hint of anything romantic. I'd followed his career on television as a fan of the two short-lived Aaron Sorkin series Sports Night and been wowed by his work on the incredible HBO show 6 Feet Under. Our paths crossed occasionally at an event or party, but I avoided handsome actor types as a rule. Over the years, I'd learned that my concerns were unfounded and there was nothing to fear. Attractive, straight, successful actors actually don't get as much attention as you might think because women find them so intimidating that they... I can't even finish that sentence with a straight face. Those dudes get all the attention you think they do and then some. So I was generally wary of what I deemed his type. But we were always friendly. Backstage that night, we made small talk. And just as our names were being announced, he turned to me and said calmly, "Wanna hold hands?" It was such an odd, old-fashioned, unexpected question. Did he mean anything by it? If we did walk out holding hands, would people think we were together? Would holding hands make it easier to walk in my very high heels? I hadn't held hands with anyone in what felt like a million years, so I decided it didn't matter. "Yes," I said, and we did. And then we presented the award, and I went back into the audience to sit back down next to my date for the evening, a gainfully employed lawyer who was also my dad. I didn't see Peter again for years. After I first moved to LA, I was in a long relationship with a wonderful guy, but I wasn't yet ready to settle down. After that ended, I contracted a case of man-repellentitis so severe that it is still being studied by the Mayo Clinic, or at least that's how it felt. For a very long time, I worked and worked and worked, and then I looked up one day, and all my friends were married with children. These married with children people were still my friends, but they'd become part of a community I wasn't in, a club I didn't belong to. Socially, their lives had completely changed, and they were busy. Their attention had turned to carpools and birthday parties and school tuition, and I was playing catch-up. "Wait, so we don't have game night anymore? You guys, who's free for dinner Saturday?" "Oh, absolutely no one?" I looked at these friends and realized, well, duh, work is gratifying, but it isn't everything, and it's no fun to sleep with at night. It just took me longer to see that, and I didn't have the same urgency they had to get to it. But then one day, just like that, I thought, I get it now. I'd be interested in this other stuff. But I'd missed the time when most people around my age had paired off. It was as if I'd misread the schedule at Penn Station, and the trains to happy couplehood had all left already. And there I was, with nothing to do but sit with the drunk businessmen at the bar and nurse a warm beer and wait for the trains to start up again. I waited and waited and waited for those trains. I attended weddings by myself, went to parties I didn't feel like going to, just in case, and was escorted to events by my dad, my cousin Tim, and my dear friend Sam. "Who's with you tonight? Oh, your dad again?" journalists would say, with a sympathetic frowny face. The only bright spot, dude-wise, was at an event where I met Matthew Perry. He became my longtime friend who I almost but never exactly dated, or Fuabned. We probably all have at least one Fuabned in our lives. My Fuabned is very special to me. At one point during this time, my father was on a plane and noticed a woman reading a magazine I was in. "That's my daughter," he said proudly. The woman turned to him with a look of pity. "Please tell her, I didn't meet my husband until late in life." "There's still time," she said. "Strangers were worried about me. That's how long I was single." There's nothing wrong with being single, unless it seems you're an actor getting interviewed a lot. Gilmore Girls was at its peak then, and I was getting interviewed a lot. During these years, when the press asked me if I was seeing someone, I'd just say, "I'm dating." Sometimes that was true, and sometimes not. Either way, I wasn't in anything secure enough to talk about or expose publicly. But over time, I felt increasingly vulnerable when I had to face these questions. Magazines don't like it when you say too little about your personal life. It makes the pages very hard to fill. If they had their way, every article would be full of sex and gossip, and I couldn't contribute stories about either. Interviewers seemed increasingly frustrated, and interviews became less about what project I was doing, and more a thinly veiled reiteration of, "Join us today as we try once again to figure out what is wrong with this poor girl who just can't seem to get a date." I knew I didn't want to stand on a red carpet and reveal too much, but I was at a loss as to what or how much to say. You may think there's a sort of school of fame where actors learn how to handle tricky situations, but there isn't. Someone call Shark Tank. Not for the first time, I wished there was someone to ask, or a Peanuts-style Lucy booth with a sign that said, "The doctor is in." I wasn't looking for a 3-month seminar, just a place I could stop into when I needed a quick answer on how to handle problems I hadn't even known existed back when all I dreamed of doing as an actor was performing in the chorus of a regional theater production of Oklahoma. How to walk in heels, don't Google yourself, and other helpful tips. How to talk to Us Weekly about your new or non-existent relationships. Take a pamphlet, 5 cents only. I learned a few things fairly easily. If you plan to be an actor who is regularly interviewed, you need to start thinking now about your favorite drugstore cheap and cheerful beauty products. Chapstick, Neutrogena Sunblock, any brand of coconut oil. Your go-